Welcome, folks, to the Real BS Show. I don't know what show this is, but we've got quite a few under our belt. We're going to do another special show this week with a guest, a special guest, a NASCAR expert. And can I say your name? Buddy Mader from Kane, Pennsylvania, originally from Kane. And he's lived the last 50 years in North Carolina.
About 22.
22 years? Okay, well, we're gonna grill him, but see if we can give away some secrets there. And maybe we'll start our own race team, huh?
Well, we got a lot of money. We could.
How about a go-kart team?
Yeah, that would be
there
more.
We go.
That would be more what we could afford.
That's more my alley.
I know those pretty well too, so we could do some stuff with that. That's changed,
yeah, right.
Probably.
Yeah. Well, we'll get into your life history. Isn't that where you started?
Yeah, that's pretty much where it did get started.
Okay. Well, we'll listen to some of this guy here singing about something about a highway or something. Life's a highway, and when he's done, we'll jump in and put you over the grill, okay?
That sounds good. I'm ready to cook.
All right. Seth, you're running the controls.
I'm on it.
Take it away. We're back with a vengeance.
The Real BS Show.
We have a very famous person with us today.
Oh, boy. Not famous, no. Nope.
Well, infamous. Well, he's spent his life practically working for NASCAR. And a very big NASCAR owner, I guess you could say.
Yeah.
You don't want to tell us who it is.
No, we'll keep that under wraps. But it's one of the top teams, we'll say.
Yeah, non-disclosure.
Yeah.
Well, okay, buddy. Well, you started in Kane, and you went to North Carolina, and maybe let's figure. I mean, there's probably a lot of people out there that would love to follow in your footsteps. I mean, you know, would love to be doing what you were doing and what you went through. and maybe you can explain to us how it all happened, you know, from the even from the beginning, you know, right when you and Jimmy got rolling.
Well, as a kid, you know, of course, Jim, he got involved with the racing business, playing around, and we ended up with stock cars locally, and I was just a kid. And it kind of just, once you get in it, it's in your blood. It's almost like anything you do that you enjoy. And it just kind of moved on. And as the older I got, then I got to the point where it was time for me to start driving. So the stock cars were getting a little more expensive at that time. So we looked at go-karts. And that seemed to be a pretty good fit. So we did the go-karts and really had a lot of success in those. Did about 10 years of that.
10 years. Wow.
Started when I was 17, and we ran all over the country for about 10 years.
You know, I got a question about go-karts I got to ask you. How fast do those things go?
They range anywhere from the sit-up carts, which they call sprint carts, can go in the mid-80s to lay-down carts that'll do 140 miles an hour with two engines on. And you run the...
I never knew that.
Well, the lay-down carts you run, like Watkins Glen, some of the different racetracks like at Daytona, Charlotte, they ran all the big road courses. The other carts you run on, a lot of the dirt tracks, usually a track built for a go-kart, and paved tracks, there's ovals, there's road courses, there's a lot of different configurations that you can do. And a lot of the series as you run throw all those in, so you've got to figure them all out. You can't just be good at one.
Right. Well, tell me about Flickerwood. That's the only one I remember.
Well, we got together
in local.
Town. Yeah, we got together in town and wanted to build a racetrack. So we went out and started turning some dirt. And before you know it, we had a little eighth-mile oval out there that was clay. And we ran on Saturdays all summer out there for, I think it was 6 years before we finally gave it up. And then we went back out kind of racing them more on our own again on the road. We were racing at home on Saturdays, and Friday nights sometimes we were doing some stuff, and Sundays we were out if we could get away and go. So maintaining the track got to be, it was tough to try to race and maintain it. So we kind of decided as a group to kind of go back to racing, and we closed it up.
Huh. Yeah, I remember Flickerwood. I was up there for some of that in
It was fun.
It was a lot of fun. Yeah, I mean, it was super interesting, yeah. Now, did you ever go 100 miles an hour in a go-kart?
Oh, yeah. I ran Charlotte a few times. most of my stuff was in the sprint carts, but I did go to Charlotte at one time. We ran down there for a big race they had. I went down with a friend of mine. He had a lay-down cart, and it was interesting. I really enjoyed that. But it took a lot of travel and to do that, so we could travel locally and do as much racing, I think, you know, so we stayed with the sprint cart stuff and did that. And then when I was about 26 or so, 27, I think it was 27 because it was about 10 years, I decided I was going to kind of slow down and not do that. And then my brother, he was still doing it, and Jim did it for another year. And then he decided he wanted a race car. So we were right back into doing that. So
I
we ended
that.
Up, yeah. So we went back to having a race car, and he was driving, and I just was working on that most of the time. So that was kind of my home stuff, and that went on until he passed away in '94, and then
wow, that long.
About 2 years after that, I kind of just got this bug. My brother-in-law Chris was working for one of the teams down there, and was down and seeing him.
Oh,
and
Chris Dana.
Yes.
Yeah,
yeah. So
so he went to North Carolina before you.
He went actually 94. He was down in 94 he moved. So he was down there then, and we had went down and visited him, and I stopped at a couple teams one day, and there seemed to be some interest, and I had resumes and just walked around and thought I'd kind of test the waters, and I had a lot of interest. So I came back, and I thought about it. That was probably 94 95, and I kind of drug my feet a little bit, but 96 I was down for the Charlotte race and visiting Chris and Chris down there, and happened to go by and picked up a newspaper, and there was a job in there at a car dealership. So I went and talked to him before I left. I had the job.
No wait a minute, before you got a job in North Carolina, didn't you have a parts store or something?
Yeah, we had Seneca Auto Parts in Kane here.
So that was supporting your habit with the go-karts.
With the go-karts, yeah, and we did cartridge pressure washers with that too. And that supported, that supported the habit.
Right. Yeah.
You got to feed the monster.
I don't think you make enough money racing to support the habit.
Not in go-karts, no, or anything, really. It doesn't even hardly support the cars, you know, unless you have really good sponsors. So, but,
okay, so you had that in your resume then as far as...
Yeah, pretty much.
Was that your shop or was that, or did you just work for somebody?
I was partners in that with a guy at one time.
Oh, okay.
So... And we left that venture, and I was working for the car dealer in town here. And I went down there, and there was a job for a GM parts guy. And I ended up, when I come home, I had to make the decision, what are you going to do here? I've got to decide if this is my way to possibly get in, because every time I talk to somebody about going to work there, they wanted you to come to work within a week. And it's pretty hard to move from Pennsylvania all the way down there in a week, get everything packed up, get rid of everything you own, and find a place and start a brand new deal. So, but I decided when I come home that was what I was going to do. And
You had the goal of working for NASCAR.
Yeah, I was the reason was this was just a job to get me to the area so I I could thoroughly look for a job and go out.
So people out there that are thinking, number one, you got to get a job that's close by.
You got to be there.
Close by the circle of people that build these cars.
There were guys at times after, when I was down there, when I first moved, that were living in motels going around looking for jobs, spending weeks at a time trying to get involved in it because of that. And that was the only way, is they had to be there and you had to actively hunt for the jobs. So that was one thing I thought, that
sounds
one
like
bridge.
A real crapshoot to me.
It was. And I was young and foolish. And I made a quick decision. I packed up everything, moved in, and there I was. I came home on a Monday and I was back down there on the next Thursday, a week later. And moved in and ready to go to work the next Monday. And that was the start. And then from there, I just kind of acted.
Now, that was a car dealership, right?
Yes, okay. Yeah, Pontiac dealer in Concord, right above the Speedway in Charlotte. Concord. So big change for me, small town, went to the big city,
that
everything.
Sounds like Dale Earnhardt country.
Yeah.
Isn't that close
well, I
to
lived
where?
In I lived in Kannapolis where all his family
oh,
is.
Oh, yeah.
Definitely. That's where my first apartment was there when I first moved. It was right not very far from where he grew up. Yeah. So it was all together there, and I was just driving over into Concord to go to work. And at that time, you could go and buy lists of the teams, and it had everybody's contact information, where they were, who you needed to talk to. So you could take those lists, and you sat home at night, and you sent resumes out. And during the day, you went out, and you actively, at lunchtime, if you were close to them, you would drop them off and stop and talk to them. And
was that difficult? I mean, was there...
It was hard to get in.
People said, don't call us, we'll call you.
They would kind of talk to you, and they'd take the resume. But when I got into the teams... I noticed that when I was looking through the files one day for something, because I'd worked in parts all the years, that there was three filing cabinets full of resumes in the one shop I was in. They would get over 100 a day at that time.
Right.
So the chances were pretty slim to get in. I mean, you really, it's kind of amazing that you can get in sometimes. I don't know what they see, but I got lucky, and... they pulled mine, and I got hired by a company then that
very large company. Is the same one you retired from?
No, it's I went to work for a smaller Busch team, and they were just getting into the Winston Cup at that time. Yeah, it was Winston Cup next, and they were just getting into that. So I was 18 months into the car dealership when that came along, and I spent about 9 months there, and then I got a call from one of the larger teams, and that was in December when the call came in and they wanted me to come to work, so I jumped to another team then. And at that time, once you were in the system, you could go from team to team. There was plenty of jobs. It was the highlight of it in 96, 97, 98. The sport was growing so fast that it was amazing. I mean, they're putting 160,000 people in Charlotte Motor Speedway for the All-Star race, you know.
Yeah. So the secret was that once you get your foot in the door, then you got some options.
You can climb the ladder if you want to work. And it's just part of the game, you know, and there was a lot of opportunity at that time. And then I worked at that race team for about a year. And then during that time, I was traveling. I was going to races every week. And
were you part of the pit crew or just?
Yeah, was doing setup, not over the wall, but set up and all the pit box, taking care of everything there. And while the guys were doing the pit stop, we all had jobs to do, you know. Yeah. So everybody was behind the wall there. You run into everybody because you see everybody every week. Every team is there.
Right.
So you start meeting people. You start rubbing elbows with people. Before you know it, they see you and they want to hire you. And pretty soon you start getting job offers that way. That's the best way. I actually bought a NASCAR license before I went to work for any of the teams. And through one of the teams, they let me do that. And then I could go and I could get to know everybody and started kind of pushing my way in a little bit.
Well, I got to say that when Chris was working for Jack Roush, you know, Mark Martin and Jeff Burton,
Jeff Burton,
he'd say, hey, come on up. We'll go to the races, you know. So I'd ride up from Alabama. I'd ride up to maybe Darlington. I'd go right up to his house, and then we'd go from there to Darlington on our motorcycles, you know. And we got, you know, sometimes Richard Petty, or not Richard Petty, but Kyle Petty, or who's that guy that worked for Earnhardt, took over his job. Started with an H, I think.
Harvick.
Yes. He used to ride too.
Mm-hmm. Oh, a lot of the guys did.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. But,
and then a lot of the team members rode.
Because we'd ride down, you know, with these guys, you know, but then it started raining on the way back, and guess what? We were riding, they were in the truck. So
yeah.
We come back pretty wet sometimes,
yeah.
but I mean, I went to Talladega. I mean, I drove my motorcycle right up on the winner's platform, you know, take my picture.
Yeah. Yeah. And that time, you know, you ran two Darlingtons a year. You ran Rockingham twice a year. You ran at Charlotte twice, plus an all-star race. And you would go up quite a while back. You know, you had Bristol, then you had two Bristols, one very far from Charlotte, you know.
Well, what I wanted to say is that you know, you look at this, it looks really wonderful on TV, you know, it looks like, wow, I'd love to do that. Well, I was with them, you know. I'd stay at the motel, you know, and they'd of course they'd stay up a little late, you know, and drinking and whatnot, but they're up at 6 a.m. and they're out there working.
Yeah, you're there early.
Hot, and I mean, it was not pleasant, you know.
It's a long day there.
Very long.
When the TV crew walks by you at Darlington in the afternoon and the race is just starting and they hold up because you can't hear anything, and they hold up a sign that says, why are you all sweating? It's only 106. And you're standing there in the sun.
I mean, I wasn't on the pit crew, so I could run back and get in Mark Martin's trailer, you know, and the ladies would fix you all kinds of food. It was air conditioned.
Cooked,
and
yes.
Yeah, they cooked like crazy. Holy cow.
Yeah, they fed everybody.
Friendly bunch. Jeez, that was pretty neat. But out there, it was hot. And
yeah.
I mean hot. And you know, it's just, they worked. And then when it was over, I mean, let's say it's a Sunday. Well, guess what? They're back to work Monday morning.
Yes, you are.
It's like they're always behind or something. That's the way I felt, you know. It's like, wow. I mean, they drove them hard.
You live your life. We used to always laugh about it, but we had calendars at work, and it had all the dates. And the salesman would come in, and they would talk, and we'd say, this is how you live your life. You live your life by every week, by where you're going with those race cars. And by Wednesday, the trucks are leaving. You got the weekend coming up done. But as soon as they leave, you start on the next week.
Right.
And
you're
already doing. And people think, oh, what do you do in the wintertime? They don't do anything. Well, in the wintertime, you're busier in the summer because the cars are all at the shop. And they take everything you own apart and start all over again because there's always rule changes. There's things they got to do, updates. If you want to build new cars and pull cars out of your fleet, you work a lot more than the season is so short because the off season is so short because you're done the week before Thanksgiving. You go back to Daytona.
It's
used
February.
To be tested in January, but they don't do that anymore. But yeah, you're back in February.
Yeah.
And you've got to have, you know, there's a swing there where you go to Daytona, you go to, I think, Atlanta now, and then you go out west for three races. You got to have almost Well, you got, if you're in a four-car team, you've got to have two cars for every week that you're going.
Right,
and
right.
They've got to be ready, and you're going to just shuffle them back and forth because your trucks won't even come back. So it's a lifestyle. It's something you love, and you do it because you thrive on it. You thrive on the competition, and it's very hard to win in that business, you know?
Yeah. Oh, definitely. I mean, what, one horsepower could make the difference.
A lot of people think, oh, yeah, that's pretty, but it's very, very hard to win. I mean, sometimes it looks easy. I used to sit and think, boy, that looked easy, but it wasn't. It was very hard. And getting to hit a good combination, to find everything, and to get everybody to work together, there's so many people. It's tough. It's a tough deal.
Yeah. Now, when it comes to the drivers, are some drivers better with the crew? I mean, I know, now I'm giving out names here, but Mark Martin had no clue who was on his pit crew. None.
He knew the guys, and he knew who they were. But
according to them guys, they didn't.
Sometimes
he'd fly in on his airplane, jump in, get in the car, go around, and back gone.
I think one of the biggest things is it's all in groups. I think you got to get certain groups work together good. And even at the racetrack, I think the two groups that are really important is the crew chief and the driver need to be able to communicate and know what each other wants. The driver needs to be able to tell him what he wants, and the crew chief needs to be able to make that adjustment. Then you've got your guys that are on the pit crew. They've all got to work just like a football team. You know, they've got a whole plan where they've got to be out there. They've got to do it. And then you've got your guys behind the wall that have got their back on pulling all the hoses to make sure nobody trips, making sure everything moves, making sure the tires are exactly where they need to be. When they come around to do the other side, it all's choreographed. I mean, they work and work and work on it. They spend so much time working out. They've gotten that to where it's pretty much they're professional athletes anymore.
Yeah, it wasn't that way when I was going with Chris, because when they jump over, I mean, well, I don't want to say anything, but I mean, I saw a commercial on TV, Jeremy Mayfield in his lawnmower. Remember Chris?
Yes, they did that down in Charlotte, yep.
Well, they come over the thing, they gassed up his lawnmower and did whatever, tires or whatever, and then they jump back over the... And I don't think Chris just about didn't make it.
Yeah, it's a different ball
game. Of course,
game.
He was carrying a gas can, too, so... It definitely wasn't an easy gig.
Yeah.
And I don't think they got the respect they needed. I didn't... I talked to Jack Roush, but I didn't get to really feel what he was really like, you know.
No, I think at that time...
And I haven't signed no non-disclosure form, so I can say whatever I want.
I think a lot of times that the competition got so big and there was so much influx of people and help that they could start looking at. They were starting to find college athletes that were getting to the pros, and they were getting guys like that in, and they were getting just very, very athletic people. And most teams have a regular pit crew coach. They've got a trainer. They probably pit practice 3 to 4 times a week. They all work out together.
Wasn't like that back in the 90s, was it?
No, it used to be when a lot of times you'd get done with work and you'd stay after work and they'd go out and pit practice and set up and do things, and then you would be out there with them. And now it's a whole separate deal. A lot of times the guys in a lot of the places just do the pit stops, and then a lot of them don't work in the shops even anymore.
Right, right.
They've gotten to that point, you know. But it's just been, it grew so much, and that got to be everybody looked at pit lane as a way to gain positions. And if you can get them on pit lane, it's a whole lot easier to pass them when you're driving down pit lane, because your pit crew is quicker than it is to fight by them on the racetrack.
But they're getting pretty close to each other now as far as split seconds. I mean, unless they have a screw up of some kind. But
well, they've all in the same pit guns now. They took those away. There was a lot of teams were building their own guns, and they got away from that. Now you have everybody on the same pit guns. So that kind of leveled the playing field a little bit. Now it's a lot of technique they look at. And what they do is when they're done with a pit stop, they'll go behind the box. Every stop is watched, on camera.
Yeah.
And they look and they see things that they want to change or what they do. And then on Monday morning, the pit crew coach, if you ever go up to their office by the gym, wherever your office, whatever shop you're in, he's there watching all of that. He watches every pit stop, and he watches other pit stops from other teams if he can get a hold of it. Somebody may have to and watch to see what they're doing. Everybody's watching to see who's got the next little trick.
Right. And it's split seconds. I mean, it's down to...
It's amazing seconds. How fast they can do that now when you start thinking, it used to be a 16-second stop was a big deal. Now they're down in 13, 12, some of them, even lower, some of these teams. So they've really worked on it. But it is a professional sport, and they're going to be the best at it.
There's other things about that. I mean, Chris used to build cars for Jack Roush and Mark Martin, Jeff Burton, and I went through the shops and stuff. I mean, I'd trip over more money than I'd make in a year, you know? I mean, it was parts laying around that were... Yeah. But what I see now is that it looks like it's all changed. They don't build the cars anymore. They don't paint them anymore. They just stretch the...
Yeah, they wrap.
They do the wraps.
That's
what I was after, yeah.
They've gotten away from the paint because the wraps, you can pull them easier. They're easier to deal with. They're lighter because they have all of the decals are integrated into the wrap. Instead, before they would paint it, then they would pull all the contingencies, all the different decals out. It just added weight to the car. It's a big, big deal with weight. Everybody's trying to figure out how to get light, and even though there is a weight rule, they try to get as light as they can because then you can put the weight back in where you want. And that's the big key to it.
Put it back in at the certain spots in the car
where you want it.
Are they at all going into like carbon fiber or anything like that?
Oh, tons of carbon. There's more and more carbon. That got to be so big that a lot of teams are even building it in-house now. They're doing their own carbon fiber. Lots of all the ductwork, but they are making some of the stuff standard where the ductwork for the radiators is the same for every car. They've went to a composite body for the Xfinity cars.
Yeah, that's what I was. Yeah.
And that's different now. It's a bolt-on application that's a lot easier to do. So they're going to be able to put bodies on cars a lot more efficiently than they would doing steel bodies like they're doing in the Cup side.
Now, if they let's say in the time trials on a Friday or whatever, and they screw up the body, they put some big dings in it or whatever, can they just pop that body off and pop another one on for Sunday?
Well, with the carbon...
Are they allowed to do that?
With the composite body, they can replace the panels. You'll go to the back. If it's after qualifying, you'll go to the back of the field.
Oh, because if you do anything.
You'll lose your spot. They could stay there. I should say if they change cars. If they go to a backup car, you go to the rear.
Right.
That's one of the things about the composite body. They'll be able to unbolt with the steel bodies. They've got to kind of work all that back out with body work without changing it.
That's what Chris used to do a lot of.
There's some good guys that can do that. They can repair those cars. But seems like with the way some of the hits, it's pretty hard to repair them. And then you spend so much time on a backup, trying to do that, you're better off to go to a backup car where you can work on your race setup instead of working on the car.
Yeah.
And take the penalty of going to the rear and just hopefully you can work your way back through.
I went down there once and I rode the Harley down. I said, shoot, I need an oil change. Chris says, well, I'll just call Strattonville, or I think it was. Is that the name of it, Strattonville up there? Yeah, Strattonville. It was just north of Morrisville.
The Harley Davidson dealer. I got to think of the name of him.
Who was their pit crew at that time?
Buddy
Perrette. Yeah. Well, I went up there, and he said, oh, geez, we can't get you in for a week.
It was Tilly Harley Davidson.
Yeah, yeah. And he said, sorry, we can't get you in for a week. And I'm only going to be here till Labor Day's over or whatever, I said, sorry. And I said, geez, I don't want to, this new motorcycle, I want to do everything right. Talk to Buddy Perrette. He said, let me take care of that. He called up there. They called me and said, come on up, bring it up. We'll take care of it right away.
He had a pretty good deal with them.
I think
at one time when they were hard to get, he had three a year he could buy. He had his name on, and if he didn't take the three, somebody else would.
Yeah.
He would give them to other guys in the shops.
Well,
that's why
a good
they
guy.
All had him.
I mean, he was
yes.
a really nice guy. And I don't know. It just the Chris was very good at body work, from what I saw.
Yeah, he did a very good job, and that
was excellent.
They're craftsmen, those guys. I mean, they're very, very, you take cars and buddy's comment one day was, we were laughing and talking about motorcycles. We were getting ready to go to Daytona, and I was over there helping him. And I didn't work for him at the time, and I just was in there trying to get my foot in the door. So I'd go on Sundays and Saturdays. And he was sitting looking at his motorcycle, and it was dripping oil. And he said, I can't figure this out. He said, we can make a race car go 200 miles an hour, but I can't keep oil in my motorcycle, he said. But the guys are craftsmen. They really were good. There's a lot of work to a steel body. Even in the old days, they had to roll a lot of the panels.
I saw a lot of that. I mean, if they get a dent in them, that screws up the aerodynamics. Yep. And Chris is out there with these rollers.
It's tough nowadays, too, when they've got rid of that dent. Yep, and they went away from templates. With templates, you used to be able to get away with, when you go to the racetrack, with, you could pound things out. You could make things fit. You could go through tech a couple times or three times. It just was a pain in the neck to do it, but they would let you. Now they go in and they electronically measure it. They do a laser scan, and they know that car, if comes out, and if it's not right, then you work on it till you get it right. And the more you go through, they start to penalize you because they don't want you going through tech all the time. So they really have made it tough for the guys that do the bodies. They do a body in about 5 to 6 days with probably 5 or 6 guys on a plate is about an average, I would say.
Wow.
And they hustle, and they fit. Huh. And I've watched guys where they're down to, they'll take a piece of wood and a hammer, and they'll hit that body in a certain spot and run it back through and check it again. That's how close it is. So just small movements, you know, that's just a lot of, it's really, really gotten to be, with the steel bodies, a lot of time in them. So we'll see what happens with that.
Well, now, when you go from, say, like a Darlington 1 mile track, maybe, to Talladega, that's what, 2.5 miles?
2.5 miles.
Well, and of course, the curves. I mean, I rode around there on my motorcycle around the tracks, you know, when nobody was. I mean, they said I could. It was all right. I was going 80 miles an hour, and I couldn't get up past the first white line at the bottom of Talladega. I mean, it was so steep. What you see on TV and what you see standing there is
very
a
steep.
Whole big difference.
Very steep. Daytona, the same way, you know.
Yeah. I bet Talladega's a lot steeper than Daytona.
It is.
Yeah.
It is, because I think you get where it always seemed, you know, when you run those two tracks, those are the two, they called them the super speedways.
Yeah.
It was a totally different car. It was all about wind tunnels and air.
So the bodies are different.
Yeah, they were for years. That was a big deal was that. But at Daytona, I think you had to handle more at times. You got to where the car, even though you were on the gas as much as they were, never letting off, you still had to handle a little better. I think Talladega, you could get away. It seemed like they just hung on, you know.
It
wasn't quite as much.
Put your foot to the floor and go. That's what it appeared to me, but I didn't, you know.
But with the COT car now, they've kind of closed the gap up on that. You still do a lot of things special for speedway cars that you wouldn't do for your short track and intermediate cars, and there is a difference. In your short track cars, of course, there's always things you're working on those, you know. It's just everything's a little different. Every racetrack's got its own little quirks.
Yeah, I was riding my motorcycle around Talladega, you know, 70, 80. They told me, well, don't go any faster than that. You know, we don't want you to screw up here. So I'm going 70 miles an hour down the straightaway, you know, right in front of the winter stand.
Mm-hmm.
And Darrell Waltrip come by going 180 miles an hour. And I mean, it was like, holy smokes. I mean, fast.
It's amazing.
I wasn't even moving. I mean, geez.
What's amazing with that whole situation that the speedway races is they run at that speed all packed together in a pack within inches of each other.
That's
some pretty professional drivers that can do that, you know.
Holy
to
cow.
Stay like that and just think, you have to be a white knuckle ride all day long like that, you know. It just, and one little movement can take the whole field out.
What do you think is the fastest track, Talladega?
Yeah, I would say
500 miles on Talladega faster than any place else.
Yeah, it depends how many wrecks you have. If you could run straight through, you could. But they've had some where they went long greens, and they were pretty quick, you know.
Yeah.
Now, Michigan's getting, you know, Michigan and California are both pretty quick, too. You're right up there at those places. And Michigan runs a long time sometimes. You can run a long time at Michigan without yellows, and it seems like
they still go as fast as Talladega?
They're close. Because
they're not banked as high as...
They're close, because, see, with the restrictor plate motors, they kind of could control that a little more where the others weren't restricted, you know. Now they've taken that away. They've quit. The last restrictor plate race was in January at Daytona, and they changed that. Now they're going to do a tapered spacer, which they can control it from anywhere than the horsepower, you know. I think they're trying to save some money on the engines. They're trying to get the owners to be able to maybe run these engines longer.
When you say a tapered spacer?
Yeah, underneath the carburetor to be a tapered spacer. Okay. And it controls the airflow, so it takes the horsepower away.
Sounds like a restrictor plate.
Yeah, it is, basically. And they can control where they want it, you know. So trying to get some longevity out of the engines, I think. That's coming, I think, more and more, you know. Huh. They've put spec engines in the trucks, and they're going to do the same, I think, possibly for the Xfinity cars as they go on, too. Yeah. So,
hey, you want to take a break? We'll play some music and you wet your whistle or whatever you got to do.
Okay.
Hey, we can pick it up on the other side and take it down the home stretch, I guess.
Okay. Sounds good.
All right.
NASCAR's biggest, most famous, prestigious race. 20 years ago this week, the great Dale Earnhardt won the Daytona 500. Drivers, start your engines!
Taking pages from a magazine, been looking for the answers ever since we were 17. You know the truth can be a weapon to fight this world of ill intentions. A new answer to the same question: how many times will you learn the same lesson? I think they got it all wrong.
20 years of trying, 20 years of frustration. Austin Dillon wins the 60th run of the Great American Race.
'Cause we're gonna be legends. Gonna get their attention. What we're doing here ain't just scary. It's about to be legendary.
Gordon got loose, it's Harvick! Harvick!
Kevin Harvick wins the Folds of Honor Quick Trip 500.
As the fans saluted Dale with the number 3 on the third lap, Kevin Harvick salutes him on the way to victory lane.
This is what we came for, and we couldn't want it anymore. We could never turn back now, got to leave it all on the floor. Been dreaming of the payoff, through the struggles and the trade-offs, fighting tooth and nail on the way. I tell them the truth, but they think it's just made up. And I think they got it all wrong, we just gotta hold on.
Chase Elliott win in the Monster Energy Cup Series.
'Cause we're gonna be legends. It's about to be legendary. Eventually they're gonna know who's right to make
Okay, we're back with the world famous Buddy Mader.
World famous, you're pushing it now.
All those people down in North Carolina know exactly who he is. And we're getting close to the end here. So, what was it like? I got a million questions and I don't know which one to ask first, but what was it like day in and day out going to work for a world famous, a big company, NASCAR company? I mean, was there frustrating days? Did you hate it? Did you love it? You know, what was it like?
You enjoyed it, but there was frustrating days. The constraint sometimes, to make things, there's no is not an answer sometimes, which you've heard that from people before. You do what you got to do to make everything work, and sometimes the days get compressed pretty close. Sometimes you're really on the edge of trying to make sure you've got parts, because the big problem is you don't want to be the guy to go to your owner and say, hey, your race cars aren't going to the racetrack today because we don't have the parts for them, or we don't have the piece to do it. So they're not going to hold the schedule up. They're not going to wait for you. So it was, you worked a lot sometimes, but it was interesting when you got to watch the cars run. You got to be involved in the competition of it, and you really felt good when you won. It was a team effort, and everybody that worked there should feel that they were part of that,
Well, you were pretty much back at the, not the office, but back at the shop.
Yeah, I stayed in the shop the last, quite a while. I got off the road. So
now, did the drivers recognize your effort, or did they come by the shop to talk to people?
They would.
I guess.
Yeah, they would come by and walk through and talk to everybody. In fact, when they won, they would come through and tell everybody, hey, good job. And the owner would come through, and the people in the different departments, everybody would congratulate everybody. And you just try to keep everybody up so you could keep that. It's a very hard thing to keep winning. Yeah. To win and win and win every week, in and out every week, is almost impossible. Sometimes there's people get on a roll and they can do it, but boy,
Jimmy Johnson.
everybody tries to keep everybody up, and there's a lot of incentives, because there's the drivers will come in and they'll buy lunch then for everybody, and everybody, that's a big deal. And when they do that, it's amazing how much everybody enjoys that, because they all get together and go upstairs and eat, or you can go to the restaurant and eat, or whatever you do,
Yeah, it makes sense. Well, if a driver would win, let's say he had a good week, he won the race, was there any little, extra chunk of coal in your stocking that week? Or
certain guys one time.
I've heard that, and I've heard that from other people.
If it's a big show somewhere, they've done some things for guys. They've on the races where they give you rings, so some drivers have bought the rings for the whole team, and instead of the employees buying it, and they do that. They monetary gifts, some little things here and there they do for them, just give them some kind of incentive. It's a big deal, and they want a big bonus race or something. Well, back when they were doing the million, that was
that.
A big deal when they were doing the million, and those guys would win that. Those drivers would kind of spread the wealth with everybody. Yeah. It was good.
But it's kind of gone away now?
Well, the teams have gotten so big that it's so hard. It used to be there was 80 employees, and now there's 300 to 400 to 500 some places,
wow.
If not more.
Holy cow.
There's just a huge, huge deal. You've got so much going on, and so big of buildings. It grew so fast and got so big that it almost grew too fast sometimes, I think.
Yeah. Do you see new owners coming in, new teams, new operations, or the same big boys?
Well, I think that it would be
Roush Racing and Earnhardt Incorporated.
The days of a small one car team coming in, or somebody coming in, unless they are, I don't know who could come in and maybe buy one of the bigger owners out, but I think, your bigger owners are all getting older. They're all probably in their 60s to 70s, and they've been in that business a long time.
Right.
It would take an astronomical amount of money, and then the whole problem would be it would take you a long time, I think, to win races.
Again.
To start from scratch and do that. So I think it would they're trying to level the playing field, but I think you would really have a hard time. You would have to have some pretty big purse strings. And I think it would be hard to get sponsors to really come back and be behind you without any kind of a track record, too.
Right. Sponsors are a big deal, then.
Sponsors pay the bills.
I remember, this was in 1999, I think, when Viagra sponsored Mark Martin.
That was big.
I'm saying, it was surprising to me, but I'm standing there. I remember that because I was standing next to his car when that guy said, "Gentlemen, start your engines." And I was out on a track standing there, and they started them engines. The ground shook.
Yeah.
I mean, the ground shook. And I was like, holy cow.
That was in the time when everybody was wanting in. You're trading dollars. Everybody used to always, we would say, well, they get this for free. And they would say, no, we don't get anything for free.
Well, see, I poked around and poked around until and I don't know if this is gospel, but I mean, I was told it was Jack Roush got $13 million for painting that car with the Viagra sign on it. Now, this was 99, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
98, 99, someplace in there.
Yeah, the budgets were very, very high at one time there. It was, it got to be pretty expensive to do it. But what they always said is you always got to look at it as it's like anything. You're trading that time on TV for the money. So what they do is there's people, I can imagine, sitting in boardrooms when they sit down and say, okay, on Monday, how much TV time did we get with this race car this week? And I can guarantee you every one of those sponsors knows how much they got. I was told Wrangler Jeans at one time back in 84, this is just a figure they threw out, $2 million or something into that budget, and they got like $8 million worth of TV time.
That's crazy. Right.
So that was one of the things. And then, everybody jumped on the bandwagon because it was so popular. I mean, there was everybody watched it.
Makes sense. I mean,
and there was Folgers. Now you got people going to the kitchen to try to sell their products. You had a Maxwell House on cars. You had anything you
Cheerios,
could think of.
Yeah.
Cheerios. Yeah. Think about all that, So it was.
So if you have a car that's out of the race after 10 laps on a regular basis,
you're hurting.
You're not going to get, no sponsor's going to give you anything.
No, it's hard. And the back markers, it's tough to be a back marker because, of course, when you watch the race, where's the TV cameras? It's up front. So that's where the money's at. So the money gravitates to the big teams and to the front teams. And the big teams and the front running teams know how to handle how to get the sponsors. They've got teams and groups of people on how to make all that work. I mean,
scientific.
There's a lot more behind that than just, hey, you want to put your name on my race car. There's a lot of give and take with that. And it's a lot for both sides. I think if they do it right, both sides work. It works out good for both sides. They both get what they need,
Yeah.
But that's how you play
business,
the game.
Big business.
That's how you play the game, and that's how they stay in business. Because you cannot, you got to have them.
Well, one time I went, because I was working in Alabama. I was working down by, Marion is south of Tuscaloosa. And I could get tickets to Talladega anytime I wanted. Square D and people like that. Just, here you go. So I went one time in the stands. Okay, in the stands. Not in the pit crew. Like with Chris. That was perfect. I loved that.
Well, Talladega's a whole different animal, so.
Man, I went up there in a stand. Number one, it was hot. Of course, it's always hot.
Yeah.
Number two, I was squeezed in like a sardine. Yep. I mean, just squeezed in. There was beer flying and then I couldn't see. I mean, the cars would come by, and I was fairly close to the track, but the wall was so high, I couldn't see the cars. I couldn't see them until they hit the curves. And it was like, man, never, ever again am I ever coming up in the stands. These people are paying big bucks to come up here, and I'm thinking they gotta be nuts.
Well, at one time, like I said, they could fill that place, and the infield was full. There was people everywhere. You couldn't sell enough tickets, it seemed like,
And
it was very popular, and the people didn't mind paying the price. I mean, Charlotte, when I moved down there, they were throwing up bleachers on the back, and they had the capability of putting 160,000 people in there, and they closed the gates at night, for the All-Star race and for the 600 and for their fall race. So,
hey, you know what? Let's do something. You're probably tired out and ready to get something to eat.
Oh, we're getting there. Yeah, you're hungry.
When I was at Darlington, I spent a lot of time around Dale Earnhardt's his trailer and the guys and stuff, because you know how they put the cars up on top and one on the bottom.
They were parked side by side with the guys you were with, I think,
probably
for quite a while. I think because they parked them by points, and I remember that year that those two trucks were side by side.
Well, I got to listen to them, and I got to, you know, after the drivers' meeting, for some, I don't know what happened, but I was standing there on the ramp going up to the drivers' meeting trailer or whatever, and they were introducing people, and he come walking around the corner all by himself, nobody around. Come up, he just smiled. Hi, how you doing? I mean, he was really, you know, I didn't expect that. I thought he was probably a crabby old guy.
No, he was pretty interesting guy. The problem he had was that when he got out, if you could get him out where nobody would bother him, he would talk forever and talk about everything. But when everybody bombarded him for autographs,
That's what I saw.
He would dive off the back of the trailer, onto the golf cart and go as fast as they could to try to outrun the mob.
Yeah, you know? right.
But when, like, you were parked next to him, if you ever were, he would come over and look at the grill to see what everybody was cooking. If he liked your food better, he'd come over there and eat with you instead of eating what those guys were cooking.
Yeah, he was a down-to-earth guy, you know what I mean? He seemed like like one of the guys or something like that, you know. But what I was saying, you know, to end this whole thing, why don't we... I found a song that was like a tribute to Dale, because he was a big star. No doubt about it.
He was NASCAR, I think. He brought it into the mainstream, I think.
Yeah.
He was the kind of guy that did.
He was ruthless out there, too. I mean, he didn't have no trouble spinning you out and passing you. Bingo, you know, it's like, hey.
Sold tickets for him. That's what he did.
I mean, he was, what do you call him, intimidator.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, and that was true. That was true. And a couple rain delays and stuff, I used to see him, and I don't know. I'm thinking, why don't we play this? We have a song, like a tribute to him.
That'd be a good idea.
And end the show that way. Thanks, buddy, for
putting
up with us. Seth, say thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you, guys. I appreciate it.
I thought Seth dozed off.
I don't doze off. No. I was listening.
Well, you're running the knobs over there, so you gotta stay awake.
We definitely appreciate you coming on.
Yeah, thanks, buddy.
Thanks for having me, and it was fun to talk about it.
Much more success in life, and maybe we'll catch up to you again. What we should do is get Chris Dana sometime on there. Maybe he didn't sign any disclosure forms. Okay. All right, Seth, you got that song?
I do.
All right. Let it rip.
Well, I was going to Daytona. I had my race gear in my pack when a stranger pulled up beside me in a stock car colored black. He was dressed like a NASCAR driver, a mustache with mirrored eyes. He said, "It's a long walk to Florida. Would you like a ride, son?" Well, I crawled across the roll cage. Then he fired that Chevy up, and the patch on his sleeve said the man had won 7 Winston Cups. His eyes was intimidating as hell as we rolled into the night, and I knew there was something strange about this ride. He said, "Boy, can you make fans stand and scream your name? Have you hit him in the ass? Never let off the gas till you rode into victory lane." He said, "Boy, do you know how it feels when you're running 3 wide? 'Cause if you're Daytona bound, let me wonder you're in for a ride." Then he cried when we got to Daytona as we pulled out on the track. He said, "This is where you get out, boy, 'cause number 3 ain't coming back." And as I climbed out of the race car, I said, "Thanks, I'll catch you later." He said, "You'll pay hell catching me, son, 'cause I'm the intimidator." He said, "Boy, can you make fans stand and scream your name? Have you hit them in the ass? Never let off the gas till you rode into victory lane." He said, "Boy, do you know how it feels when you're running 3 wide? 'Cause if you're Daytona bound, let me warn you, you're in for a ride." He said,
said, boy, can you make fans stand to scream your name? Have you hit them in the ass? Never let off the gas till you rode into victory lane. He said, boy, do you know how it feels when you're running three wide? Cause if you're Daytona bound, let me warn you, you're in for a ride. If you're Daytona bound, let me warn you, you're in for a ride. The last ride.
Disappointed with our finish at Martinsville, but it's great to come out on the points. So we needed to notch that 24 car a little bit. We, you know, he's been steadily gaining for the last couple of weeks, and everybody's talking about his momentum. I'm gonna show you something about momentum.